Tonight's talk is on wise mindfulness, the seventh part of the Eightfold Path. The Pali word for mindfulness is sati, S-A-T-I. Gil Fronsdell translates this phenomenon as, quote, the presence of mind needed for strong, balanced awareness. In the Theravada tradition, the key teaching on mindfulness is the Satipatthana Sutta, which sets out what's called the four foundations of mindfulness, which I'll discuss more pretty soon. The Satipatthana Sutta says that practice with the four foundations needs to be done with the following three characteristics or inclinations of mind. One, clear comprehension, paying attention in order to understand what's observed. Two, ardency, determined, enthusiastic exertion, such as an ardent gardener or cyclist. And three, a willingness to put aside, quote, preoccupations with things of the world, end quote. This is to get the mind out of the grip of desire and or aversion. And when we can't put these preoccupations aside, we focus on the effect they're having on our body and mind. So when these three qualities of mind that I just listed are present, and we're paying attention to the breathing, then we're doing mindfulness practice. There is some very thoughtful controversy about the definition of mindfulness, even how to translate the word sati. Tanissero Bhikkhu disagrees with what he calls modern writers, which apparently includes Bhikkhu Bodhi, who say that mindfulness is a non-judgmental, bare awareness. You may have heard that before. And that is a decidedly passive experience. Tanissero translates sati as memory, a more active process of holding an experience in the mind so we can chew on it and digest it, not intellectually, but experientially. I have to wonder if we can ever describe in the words of any language what happens in that moment when we observe a thought and feeling that is associated with the thought and discern what has actually happened. We know what it's like. We experience it, sometimes habitually. But putting it into words, I think, demonstrates that this is not an intellectual exercise. Now, right about here, though, is where I get a persistent question. But I thought we weren't supposed to think during meditation. So for tonight, let's just acknowledge that mindfulness is not utterly passive. The mind knows what it's experiencing, and is able to guide the attention this way or that, essentially making decisions about how to practice, and meanwhile, learning about our inner being. That's a lot of activity without doing discursive thinking. So we're definitely not thinking in the sense of daydreaming or planning or pondering the problems of life. Just noticing what's going on and coming to understand it. The Satipatthana Sutta teaches us what in our human experience we should examine and how to do so in order to end momentary or overall dukkha or suffering. Another sutta of key importance in understanding mindfulness is the Anapanasati Sutta, which walks us through the method for watching the breath, which is similar to the way I led the meditation tonight. Together, these suttas solidly anchor us in the internal experience of how the body feels. This can be hard to teach because Westerners have become robot brains encased in a layer of uncooperative flesh. I enjoyed that so much. I'm going to say it again. We have become, not all of us, many of us have become robot brains encased in a layer of uncooperative flesh. So many of us are shockingly ignorant of our own physical sensations. Pulmonologists sometimes seem completely befuddled when I describe my breathing quite precisely, because I suspect even they don't know how it feels to breathe. Here's how the Anapanasati Sutta teaches us to breathe. Breathing in long, a practitioner discerns, I am breathing in long. Or breathing out long, he discerns, I am breathing out long. Or breathing in short, she discerns, I am breathing in short. Or breathing out short, she discerns, I am breathing out short. They train themselves, I will breathe in sensitive to the entire body. They train themselves, I will breathe out sensitive to the entire body. And no, the Pali was not quite so gender fluid as that paragraph. But after being thoroughly grounded in the body, the sutta then turns our attention to other teachings which we breathe in and out, feeling them in the body. And you might ask, how do we learn to feel this if we've never really experienced the body from the inside? And at the start of most meditations, I usually guide the Sangha to the regular places to observe the breath, the diaphragm, the ribs, and where the air touches the body going in and out. It can help to conceptualize what we're feeling in terms of the ancient notion of the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. Deb gave a Dharma talk on these elements a few weeks ago. The ribs and diaphragm have some solidity to them, like the earth, and there's some warmth, the fire element that's generated by their exertion. The breath, which is air, can feel cool and dry as it enters the body, and then warm and moist, the water element, as it's exhaled. These aren't the only sensations involved in breathing, but if you look for and observe these, you'll get to feel others. They'll be there. The Satipatthana Sutta starts out with the breath and then goes on to explore the body through postures, anatomical parts, such as the fluids in the body, etc. It examines them as the elements, and then, a bit gruesomely, it has us contemplate the decomposition of the body as a corpse. The sutta also has us contemplate all these aspects of the body externally, which is more like the contemporary way most people are conscious of the body. And it's also the only way that we can contemplate bodies decomposing. And that's an exercise that's meant to loosen our attachment to the body and its appearance. The crucial point I want to make is that experiencing what the body feels from the inside is indispensable to the practice of mindfulness. As I said in the beginning of this talk, there are four foundations of mindfulness. The body is the first and by far the longest part of the sutta. Next, there's Vedana, V-E-D-A-N-A, a set of three feeling tones that accompany all experiences. The third foundation is called mind, and the fourth is Dharma. I should note that most English terms for these parts of the sutta vary a lot, just to keep you on your toes. Once we become familiar with our internal bodily sensations, then we're ready to explore Vedana. It's very important, even though Vedana is devilishly hard to experience when it first arises, because it's instantaneous and faint. But the practice is to look for it, and the three types are pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. With every experience we have, we like, we dislike it, or we don't feel either way about it. Vedana happens the moment our senses make contact with anything. I look at a light, I have some affective response to it. This response can be so subtle that we're completely unaware of it until it's grown bigger into desire, aversion, or a spacey detachment. Now, our reactions to things occur on a continuum. English has different names for liking, disliking, and not caring, as each feeling grows stronger. The list of mind states I gave you last month to help you practice wise effort is our language's way of identifying Vedana in a variety of contexts. Some of those words represent the same feelings as others when they're more or less intense. In its extreme, liking is craving. Not liking is hatred in its extreme. And neutral's extreme is being so detached that one is delusional. Vedana represents the seeds that grow into dukkha. The best place to spot it and arrest its growth is at the stage of mild desire, or with dislike, mild resistance, or with neutral, it's when it becomes a slight indifference. As the middle stage, these feelings can nudge us toward making decisions. If we're mindful of the Vedana involved and set aside its influence, those decisions can become wise responses rather than impulsive reactions. Also importantly, mindfulness of Vedana can let us keep whims from growing into habitual compulsions and give us the power to take apart those habits that we've already acquired, which are set into motion by our triggers. Now, I'm going to take a chance and say that we all have some habitual reactions that can get triggered and snap us into unwise actions. Anybody who doesn't? So, the next foundation of mindfulness takes us deeper into the mind, that mysterious territory where our moods, attitudes, assumptions, values, etc. live and work. Practicing with this part of the sutta is somewhat like do-it-yourself psychotherapy. And I learned when I took a retreat into a women's prison where there isn't much support, that this is an area where if we have a history of trauma, or we know that there are some areas that are particularly difficult for us, this shouldn't be a substitute for psychotherapy. It would be good to have at least a wise friend's support as we begin to work with this. Now, at least for me, it seems weird that this foundation, the mind, gets the least words in the sutta. But there's a lot to unpack in it. It takes the I, me, or mine out of our relationship to states of mind by having us study them, not as a permanent part of our own minds, but as an event that arises, has an effect on us, and passes away. Those who actively practiced with wise effort last month have an advantage in doing this. You who've been practicing with it have been regarding your mind states for 6 weeks now. And in the next 3 weeks, you won't be trying to manipulate them so much as we do with wise effort. The goal here is just to delve into mind states, and it's hoped come to understand them better. The acronyms that have become popular in recent decades are a way of putting this practice into a nutshell. RAIN, R-A-I-N, has morphed a bit lately, thanks to Tara Brach. The goal, overall goal, is to relax, be compassionate toward yourself, and let the truth of what occurs in the mind reveal itself to you. All sorts of creepy, undesirable emotions, attitudes, and moods occur to us, to all of us, not just you, and none of it is you. Just like we do when we're watching suspense movies, they have an appeal. And let this observation of what happens in your mind play out without any resistance or attachment, just like you would watch a suspense movie. It's a light show on a wall, and you can watch it shift and fade before your eyes. Witnessing and understanding this will enable you to let go of your clinging to any part of it. Practice with this foundation also helps us relax our grip on the characteristics we think add up to me. This practice progresses, and as it does so, we often see what causes these various states of mind to arise. It can be just like a session of psychotherapy. Oh, that's why I feel this way when that happens. If we watch it like a movie, it doesn't hurt, and we still get the joy of realizing in the end the true nature of what's going on. This can happen when we focus first on the breath in the body, and then open our focus to include what arises in our awareness while we remain, as the sutta puts it, independent of what we see and not clinging to anything in the world. Now, I've brought practice handouts, like all the previous months with the Eightfold Path, and on the back of them, there are photocopied excerpts from Anallio's book on the Satipatthana Sutta. It includes his diagram of this shifting of attention from the breath to the other objects of contemplation mentioned in the sutta, which he has arranged like flower petals around the central circle of the breath. Breathing is the anchor of our attention, where we return after contemplating whatever arises, the way our posture feels, or how it feels to walk, whether it's pleasant or not, a flash of memory that evokes some attitude, or one of the hindrances. Just as you practiced with wise effort, by focusing on how a mind state makes you feel, It's also important in practicing with the mind. We need to pay attention to how all of our experience feels. As the Buddha said, all of the Dharma is contained in the body. Staying with physical sensations lets us glimpse the hidden places of the mind, where secrets are often released into our consciousness as insights. To do all this, wise mindfulness requires an unattached mental posture, which in turn requires our love and compassion for ourselves. In sum, a radical acceptance of our experience. That may be a tall order. And we get some help from the fourth foundation, where we're given a list of the Buddha's teachings to practice with. It's at this point in the Satipatthana Sutta that most Dharma talks about it kind of peter out, because this is a list of lists, kind of torpor-inducing to some people. It's the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense spheres, the seven factors of awakening, and then it returns to where we started on the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths. Okay, as far as that list is concerned, you would do well to practice with the five hindrances. Desire, aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt. For example, you're sitting there, the stomach growls, and then desire arises for a snack, and you want to leave your meditation to go get one. Or some attitude that you're ashamed of arises, and you want to quit meditating because it's getting too creepy. That's aversion. Or you start to fall asleep, torpor. Or you can't stay focused, restlessness. Or you think your meditation session is just a waste of time, doubt. There are antidotes to all of these hindrances. But here, for the purposes of Dharma in the Satipatthana Sutta, the practice is not to dismiss the hindrances, but to focus on how you feel when the mind is in these states. There's a question that Gil Fronsdale taught me to ask, and over the years, it's yielded many riches. What would I be experiencing if I didn't have this desire, aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, or doubt? Just that shift of my relationship to a hindrance has often opened the curtain that it has drawn across my mind, revealing the sad little mind state that's masquerading as the Wizard of Oz. The things that hold us back are not as powerful as they seem, and they are not permanent parts of us. They come and go, and studying with them, with acceptance, metta, and compassion, can set us free. The fourth foundation also includes the seven factors of awakening, another set of teachings that are accessible and very helpful. And as I've said, with every part of the Eightfold Path, it's of little benefit to know about it intellectually compared to the value of regularly practicing with it. When you look through the practice guides I've given you, some things may seem inaccessible at first, but these are all things that I do all the time. These exercises become habits and very helpful ones. And practicing this way, you eventually become the ardent gardener of your own internal garden, and it becomes a good place to live. Thank you.